A lesson before dying.
Sun going down. I know this the last one I'm gonna ever see. But gonna see one more sunrise, cause I ain't gonna sleep tonight. I won't sleep a long time after tomorrow.
That's actor Gilbert McCauley playing the part of Jefferson in Ernest J. Gaines' novel, A Lesson Before Dying. We'll hear excerpts from a dramatic reading in the first half of the show.
It was important in his experience to be able to understand what a person was about and not make a mistake. I think those same sorts of instincts would have served him well in going to France. Let's face it would have been an experience almost as different as our going to Turkmenistan or Mongolia.
And that's Thad Carhart talking about Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau, the son of the Indian Sacajawea who accompanied Lewis and Clark on their famous expedition. We'll talk to him about his new novel about Charbonneau, Across the Endless River. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. One in seven people sentenced to die are later proven innocent, according to studies cited by the ACLU. This terrible injustice is one of the themes of Ernest J. Gaines' powerful book, A Lesson Before Dying. Another is the dignity of all human beings, no matter their situation. Gaines, who is probably best known as the author of Driving Miss Daisy, explores these themes through the story of Jefferson, a young black man who is sentenced to death for his role in a botched robbery, even though he is not the killer. The action takes place in rural Louisiana during the 1950s, when Jim Crow was still very much alive. Published in 1997, and an Oprah favorite, A Lesson Before Dying was chosen as this year's selection for One Book Holyoke, a community project based on the idea of the Big Read, a program by the National Endowment for the Arts to encourage reading. When I interviewed the founder of the Big Read, Dana Joya, back in 2005, he asked me why there were no Big Read programs in Massachusetts. Well, there are some now, and One Book Holyoke has gotten support from the Big Read. The idea is simple. Holyoke residents read a selected book during a set period of time. Then they get together for a variety of activities planned around the book. One of them was a dramatic reading by the Holyoke-based company Enchanted Circle Theater. They compressed the action of the book into a dramatic script of about an hour and a half. Writer's Voice went to one of the readings at Holyoke City Hall for an audience of local high school students. You can hear the entire reading at writersvoice.net, but here are some excerpts from the production. The actors are Gilbert McCauley as Jefferson, James Lightfoot as Grant Wiggins, LaQuisha Parks as Jefferson's godmother, and James Emery in the roles of the book's white characters, the defense lawyer and Mr. Henri Pichot. In this first segment, taking place at Jefferson's trial, his lawyer appeals to the jury for mercy because, he says, Jefferson isn't really human, implying that he's subhuman and therefore can't be held accountable for the crime.
Gentlemen of the jury, this man planned a robbery? pardon me. I sure did not mean to insult your intelligence by saying man. Would you please forgive me for committing such an error? Gentlemen of the jury, who would be hurt if you took this life? Now look back to the second row. Please look, I want all 12 of you honorable men to turn your heads and look back to that second row. What you see there has been everything to him. Mama, grandmother, godmother, everything. Look at her, gentlemen of the jury, look at her well. Take this away from her, and she has no reason to go on living. We may see him as not much, but he's her reason for existence. Think on that, gentlemen. Think on it. Gentlemen of the jury, be merciful. For God's sake, be merciful. He is innocent of all charges brought against him. But let us say he was not. Let us for a moment say he was not. What justice would there be to take this life? Justice, gentlemen? Why, I would just as soon put a hog in the electric chair as this.
That Jefferson is sentenced to death is bad enough, but that he's been called a hog by his lawyer adds insult to injury. Jefferson's godmother, who raised him from the age of 6, determines to have her godson's dignity returned to him, and in order to do so, she enlists the help of her nephew, the local schoolteacher, Grant Wiggins. She prevails upon him to go with her to talk with Mr. Henri Pichot, the plantation owner who she's worked for all her life. In this segment, we hear Grant speaking first as he goes with the godmother and her son together to Mr. Henri's antebellum mansion.
I follow them into the inner yard, up the stairs to the back door. The maid, Inez Lane, has seen us come into the yard, and she opened the door for us. Inez was in her early 40s, I suppose.
I would like to speak to Mr. Henri if he's home.
I did not hear Inez knock on the library door or hear a call, but I did hear Henri Pichot's voice.
Yes, Inez. Yeah, what is it? Who? Did she say what she wanted? You go back there and ask her what she wants.
Inez came back into the kitchen.
Just tell him I'd like to speak to him. It's important.
Inez started back up the hall, but Henri Pichot had already left the library. He was a medium-sized man of medium weight. He could have been in his mid-60s. His hair was white and long, and he held a drink.
What can I do for you, Emma?
I want to ask you a favor, Mr. Henri. It's Jefferson.
Yes, I heard.
I want to ask you a favor.
I can't change what has been handed down by the court. I spoke up before the trial. I can't say any more.
Yes, sir. But that's not what I come to ask you for. I come to ask you something else.
Miss Emma looked tired. She was tired. She wanted to sit down at the table, but no one had offered her a chair. My aunt put her arm around her shoulders to comfort her and to help her stand. I looked at the two white men who raised their glasses. Henri Pichot finished his drink and stuck out his hand. Inez knew what it meant, and she came forward to get the empty glass.
They call my boy a hog, Mr. Henri. Jefferson gonna need me, but I'm too old to be going up there. My heart won't take it. I want you to talk to the sheriff for me. I want somebody else to take my place.
That's up to you and Mr. Sam, isn't it?
I need you to speak for me, Mr. Henri. I want the teacher visit my boy. I want the teacher make him know he's not a hog, he's a man. I want him to know that before he go to that chair, Mr. Henri. Now, I done a lot for this family and this place, Mr. Henri. And I'm asking you talk to the sheriff for me. I done a lot for this family over the years.
I can't promise anything.
You can speak to your brother-in-law.
And say what?
I want the teacher talk to my boy for me.
He looked over her head at me, standing back by the door. I was too educated for Henri Pichot, and he had no use for me at all anymore. But just as Miss Emma had given so much of herself to that family, so had my aunt. So Henri Pichot, who cared nothing in the world for me, tolerated me because of my aunt.
And what do you plan to do?
I have no idea, sir.
You think you can change him from a hog to a man in the little time he's got left?
I have no idea, sir.
But you're willing to try if I can get Mr. Sam to let you go up there.
That's what she wants, sir.
But you didn't put her up to this.
No, sir, I did not.
He did it, you know. I spoke for him because of you. But all the time, I knew he did it.
If you say so, Mr. Henri.
I say so.
That's not what I come up here for, Mr. Henri. I'm not begging for his life no more. That's over. I just want to see him die like a man. This family owe me that much, Mr. Henri, and I want it. I want somebody to do something for me one time before I close my eyes. Somebody got to do something for me one time before I close my eyes, Mr. Henri. Please, sir.
I'll speak to him, but it's up to him, not me.
Tell him what I done for this family, Mr. Henri. Tell him to ask his wife all I done for this family over the years.
I said I would speak to him.
When?
Henri Pichot had started to raise his glass because for him the conversation was over. But when Ms. Emma spoke again, his hand stopped inches away from his mouth and he lowered the glass.
What?
When?
Whenever I see him, that's when. Now, if you don't mind,
Mr. Henri.
But he kept walking.
I'll be up here again tomorrow, Mr. Henri. I'll be on my knees next time you see me, Mr. Henri.
But she was speaking in empty space. Henri Pichot and Louis Rigon were already in the library.
Pichot does, in fact, convince the sheriff to let Grant Wiggins visit Jefferson in his cell for lessons to help him reclaim his dignity as a man. At their first meeting, Jefferson doesn't make it easy for the teacher.
Jefferson sat on his bunk with his head bowed and his arms hanging down between his legs. The deputy opened the door for me to go in, and he reminded me that he would be back within the hour. Jefferson, your nanan couldn't make it today. She has a bad cold, but she sent you something. How are you feeling, Jefferson? After a while, he raised his head, but he didn't look at me. He looked at the barred window. From the cell, all you could see were the yellow leaves on the sycamore tree and the pale blue sky between the leaves. You hungry?
You bought some corn?
Corn?
That's what hogs eat.
He had not washed his face or combed his hair for days. I didn't bring any corn. You're not a hog. When's the last time you ate?
I don't know.
Today?
I don't know.
He was playing with me, and I knew it. Some chicken in there, biscuits and sweet potatoes, even some candy she made. You ought to try it. It'll make her happy.
Hogs don't eat candy.
You're no hog. You're a man. He grunted deeply in his throat and grinned at me. Mind if I have a piece of your chicken? I left before dinner. He acted as though he had not heard me. I took out a drumstick and a biscuit and started eating. Your nanny can sure cook.
That's for humans.
You're a human being, Jefferson.
I'm an old hog. Humans don't stay in no stall like this. I'm an old hog. They fattening up to kill.
That'll hurt your nanny if she heard you say that. You want me to tell her you said that?
Old hog don't care what people say.
She cares, and I do too, Jefferson.
Y'all humans.
You're a human being too, Jefferson.
I'm an old hog. Just an old hog they fattened up to kill for Christmas.
You're a human being, Jefferson. You're a man. He kept his eyes on me and as he got up from the bunk.
I'm going to show you how old hog eat.
He knelt down on the floor and put his head inside the bag and started eating without using his hands. He even sounded like a hog. I stood back watching him while I continued to eat the biscuit and a piece of chicken.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're airing excerpts from a dramatic reading by the Enchanted Circle Theater of Ernest J. Gaines's A Lesson Before Dying. It was this year's selection of One Book Holyoke, a grassroots community reading project. The second meeting between Jefferson and Grant Wiggins goes better.
When I came up there a couple of days later, the chief deputy told me I could meet Jefferson in his cell or in the day room. I told him it didn't matter to me where we met, The chief deputy told me it didn't matter to him either, but he told Paul to take me to the day room. I sat there at the center table, and I heard the chains out along the cell block before I saw anyone. Then they came in, Jefferson in front, shackled, walking short steps with his head bowed and his shoulders stooped. They came up to the table, and Paul told him to sit down. He sat without looking at me, his shoulders hanging low and his closer together than they should be. How's it going?
All right.
You want to eat something?
I ain't hungry.
Yes, you are. I know I am. There was store-bought bread, fried pork chops, and baked sweet potatoes. I put some of it in front of him and some in front of me. I started eating. Come on, eat something. He raised his head slowly and studied me a while. He had lost some weight. What had been a round, smooth face when he first came here was beginning to show some bone structure. His eyes were still bloodshot. I had seen them many times in my sleep the past month.
What you want?
Just want you to eat something, that's all.
What you want?
Us to talk.
About what?
I don't know. Anything you want to talk about. What do you want to talk about?
That chair.
We're starting our Christmas program. You remember those Christmas programs when you were in school?
It's Christmas.
No, Christmas is still a few weeks off, but we're getting ready.
That's when he was born or when he died.
Who? Born.
That's right. Easter, when they nailed him to the cross. And he never said a mumbling word.
I had not finished eating, but I knew I couldn't eat anymore. I put the rest of the pork chop and a slice of light bread on a napkin before me. Jefferson, do you know what moral means? Obligation? Do you know what obligation means? No matter how bad off we are, we still owe something. You owe something, Jefferson. Not to me, surely not to that sheriff out there, but to your godmother. You must show her some understanding, some kind of love.
That's for you humans. I ain't no human.
Then why do you speak, Jefferson? Human beings are the only creatures on earth who can speak. Why do you talk and wear clothes? Why do you wear clothes?
You trying to get me wool gathered.
I'm not trying to confuse you, Jefferson. She loves you, and I want you to give her something. Something that she can be proud of.
Hogs don't give nothing. Hogs don't leave nothing.
Jefferson, do you like coming out here, or you prefer standing in the cell?
Anything y'all want. Don't matter to me.
It matters to her, Jefferson. Out here, she can sit down. You can be kinder to her, Jefferson. Every time she comes up here, she comes back to the quarter looking worse and worse.
She ought to stay at home.
All she do is worry more if she didn't see you.
Hogs don't worry. Hogs just know.
Hogs don't know anything, Jefferson. Only human beings know. Only human beings worry.
This hog know. Fattening it up for Christmas, kill him at Christmas time.
Nobody is going to die at Christmas time.
How you know? They told you?
Nobody told me anything. I just know. Nothing is going to happen at Christmas.
I'd be glad when it's over. Old Hall, get some rest then.
Do you want me to leave, Jefferson?
Leave when you want. Old Hall don't care.
He lowered his head and the chain jangled under the table. I wanted to leave, but it was too early. The sheriff would have his proof that I hadn't reached Jefferson and that I was giving up. A half hour later, Paul came in to return him to his cell. Jefferson walked in short steps, his head bowed and his arms hanging low, his shoulders too close together. After locking him in, Paul came back to the day room, and he and I walked down to the main floor together.
Jefferson does regain his dignity, as we see in this next segment.
You can look at me, Mr. Wiggins. I don't mind.
I raised my head and saw him standing there under the window, big and tall and not stooped as he had been in chains.
I'm gonna do my best, Mr. Wiggins. That's all I can promise. My best.
You're more than a man than I am, Jefferson.
Because I'm going to die soon? That make me a man, Mr. Wiggins?
My eyes are closed before this moment, Jefferson. My eyes have been closed all my life. Yes, we all need you. Every last one of us.
So pretty out there. So pretty. I ain't never seen it so pretty.
I looked at him standing there big and tall, his broad back toward me.
Mr. Wiggin, you say write something, but I don't know what to write. And you say I must be thinking about things I ain't telling nobody, and I ought to put it on paper. But I don't know what to put on paper because I ain't never wrote nothing but homework. I ain't never wrote a letter in all my life because Nana used to get other children to write a letter and read a letter for her, not me. So I can't think too much to say. But maybe next time. I don't want to sleep at all tonight no more. Just catnap in the day while they got the light on and they got noise, because I don't want to dream about that door every time I shut my eyes. When they brought me in the room and I see Nana at the table, I see how old she look and how tired she look, and I told her I love her. I told her I was strong, and she just look old and tired and pull me to her and kiss me, and it was the first time she had ever done that, and it felt good. And I let her hold me long as she want. Because you say it was good for her, and I told her I was strong and she didn't need to come back no more. Because I was strong. She just sit there with her eyes most shut, like she want to go to sleep, looking at me all the time, till Reverend and Miss Lou have to help her up and take her back home. I'm sorry I cry, Mr. Wiggin. I'm sorry I cry when you say you ain't coming back tomorrow. I'm strong, and Reverend Ambrose got gonna be here with me, and Mr. Harry coming too. And reason I cry, cause you've been so good to me, Mr. Wiggin, and nobody ain't never been that good to me. Make me think I'm somebody. Sheriff Guidry asked me what I want for supper, and I told him I want Nana to cook me some okra and some rice and some pork chops and some cornbread and some cobbler. And he said he gonna see what he can do and say that what I want for dessert. And I say, just a little ice cream in a cup and a moon pie. They took me and let me stand under the shower with a new bar of soap. And they gave me a big clean white towel and brought me back and put me in some clean clothes. And I sat down because my food was here, and I ate it. I ate every bit. It was the best meal I know my Nana ever cooked. Sun going down. I know this the last one I'm gonna ever see. but gonna see one more sunrise, cause I ain't gonna sleep tonight. I won't sleep a long time after tomorrow. And the place is quiet. Quiet, but nobody's sleeping. They got a moon out there. I can see the leaves on the tree, but I ain't gonna see no more leaves after tomorrow. I don't know if they got a heaven, cause Samson say ain't can't be, and Boo, he say ain't none for no nigga. But Reverend Ambrose say there is one for all. Me and Bach don't know. I've been shaking and shaking, but I'm gonna stay strong. Ain't had no business going there with Brother and Bear, cause they ain't no good, and I'm gonna be meeting them soon. It's quiet. Quiet, and I can hear my teeth hitting, and I can hear my heart. When I was a little boy, I was a water boy and rode the cart, but now I got to be a man and sit in a chair. Don't know if you can read this, Mr. Wiggin. My hand's shaking, and I can hear my heart. I can hear Randy, but I ain't listening no more, because he for the living and not for me. It's late, and I don't know what time it is, but I know it's late. Day breaking. Sun coming up. The bird in the trees sound like a bluebird. Sky blue. Blue, Mr. Wiggin. Goodbye, Mr. Wiggin. Tell him I'm strong. Tell him I'm a man. Goodbye, Mr. Wiggin. I'm gonna ask Paul if he can bring you this. Sincerely, Jefferson.
That was Gilbert McCauley reading the part of Jefferson in Ernest J. Gaines's novel, A Lesson Before Dying. The other actors included James Lightfoot as Grant Wiggins, Laquisha Parks as Jefferson's godmother, and James Emery, who played the defense lawyer and Mr. Henri Pichot. You can hear the whole reading at writersvoice.net. Just find and follow the link. You'll also find interviews with actors James Lightfoot, who played Grant Wiggins, and Laquisha Clark, who played Miss Emma, Jefferson's godmother. Next up, we talk with Thad Carhart about his new novel, Across the Endless River. Stay tuned.
Oh, oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave. Go home to my Lord and be free. No more mourning, no more mourning over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in a grave. I'd go home to my Lord and be free. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave. I go home to my Lord, and I'll be free. Come and go with me to that land.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Thad Carhart's first book was a memoir, The Piano Shop on the Left Bank, in which he chronicled finding a piano shop tucked away on a little street that helped him rediscover his love of playing the piano. An American citizen with an Irish passport who lives in Paris, Carhart is an expatriate par excellence, like the protagonist of his new book, Across the Endless River. It's an historical novel about the fascinating life of Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau. He was the son of the Indian Sacajawea and a French-Canadian voyageur. He was born while his parents were accompanying the explorers Lewis and Clark on their famous expedition of 1804 to 1806. I asked Thad Carhart to tell us more about who Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau was.
Well, he was born in 1805, and he was born at the beginning, really the first winter of the Lewis and Clark expedition. And I mention that because his mother was Sacagawea, the Indian translator for the expedition, and his father was Toussaint Charbonneau, a French-Canadian trappeur or fur trader on the upper Missouri, and he, too, was a translator for Lewis and Clark. So there was this improbable circumstance of just his birth. What I did know, and a lot of people do know, especially since the $1 coin was issued in 2000, commemorating the bicentennial, preparing for the bicentennial of Lewis and Clark, it depicts Sacagawea with a papoose on her back, a baby, and that is my principal character. At the time, his name was Pompey, the Shoshone name for a little chief or firstborn, but his Christian name was Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau. And to make a long story short, he was carried by Sacagawea across the North American landmass to the Pacific, where Lewis and Clark ended up. And then they turned around and walked back, and she with them, with her baby. So it's just the beginning of his life was a remarkable story of, almost miraculous story of survival, given the numbers of people who died on the frontier at any age, but particularly infant mortality was very high. What I hadn't known is that when he was a young man, he grew up both in the Indian villages of the Mandan, where his parents were on the upper Missouri, and as William Clark's ward in St. Louis, which was the jumping-off point for the Trans-Mississippi West. And what I learned is that at the age of 18, he was invited by a German aristocrat who was investigating the flora and fauna of the upper Missouri. He was invited to come back to Europe with this Duke Paul of a small kingdom called Württemberg, and he went. And so that was the thing that most captured my imagination and is really the arc of my narrative in this novel.
And what captured your imagination most about that fact that he had, where he had come from and where he had gone to?
Initially, it was just the mere fact surprised me. I hadn't known this, and of course, that's always intriguing and interesting. But that by itself really wasn't. After my excitement settled down a bit, I thought about it, but the story wouldn't leave my mind. And the reason I think is because when I thought about it, and I realized there was very little. I found out fairly early on that was very little documentary evidence about his time. We knew that he went, and we knew he came back. We have ship's logs and a couple of references in correspondence and so forth, but very little original documentation. So I thought, well, this is going to be a work of the imagination, which suited me. But in order to imagine it, I wondered, and what continued to intrigue me was, here's this young man who came from a world that was about as different as could be from 1820s Europe. And it wasn't just one world, of course. It was the world of the voyageurs and the explorers and the settlers of St. Louis, essentially the white man's world of settlement. But he also had a very strong grounding in Mandan culture, which is one of the Siouan tribes on the upper Missouri. and had spent a good part of his boyhood there. So linguistically and culturally, he really had a foot in two worlds. So I wondered, what would it have been like then to go to this entirely different continent, this other place, with those, with that background, with those languages? And that was what continued and continues to intrigue me. What would he have seen? What would his, and how would he have seen it? That's really what intrigues me. I suppose in that sense there is a parallel in my mind, not with my experience per se, but with the subject of my first book, The Piano Shop on the Left Bank. What is our experience? Why is it, and how might a reader be interested in imagining the intersection of two worlds, one of which they know and one of which they don't?
And you yourself have dual citizenship, American and Irish, and yet you live in France. tell us how that has been for you. I'll disclose here that I spent 8 months living in the south of France. Mm-hmm. It was a place I fell in love with. I felt like it was the home of my heart. And yet at the same time, I also often felt it was a struggle to mm-hmm. be in a place where, always talking in a language that was not my native language, trying to figure out just how to get around.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's true for a lot of us who both, whether you choose to live there long term, that is, in another country, or even for a short, 8 days or 2 weeks is not enough. That's more a trip. But 8 months, that's a good chunk of time. That I think of the French word, which we don't really have a good equivalent to. That's dépaysé, which is to be uncountried. And what they mean by uncountried, because the French so love their own country, and for good reason, is that you really are taken out of your experience and what your comfort zone, I suppose we'd call it these days, and you linguistically and culturally and on every level, you have to pay attention. You have at all points you're attentive if you want to learn anything at all times. And of course, that's exhausting initially, but it's also it means, I think, that you will never quite see the world in the same way. I think that's ultimately good for all of us, whether we go back to the same town and live there for the rest of our lives, or we have different experiences, doesn't really matter as much as having the sense and having the experience, not just the intellectual proposition, but knowing from your own experience that people live by different lights with different frames of reference, that there are immutable characteristics in the human experience, and that, of course, comes to the fore when you deal with people from the heart, as you say. I think that's terribly important, and that's what I think a lot of my readers are drawn to in these stories.
And you're also very dependent on the kindness of strangers, which is, mm-hmm. I think, both a spiritually strengthening place to be for both you and them, but also one that can excite some difficulty, some resentment, some anxiety. And that also happens for your hero, Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau. He has a complicated relationship with Duke Paul of Württemberg, his benefactor and his boss.
That's right. It's fair to say that he wouldn't have used these words because they weren't contemporary words, but it's a power relationship, and he does recognize that underlying fact. He came from the fur trapper experience, at least one part of his experience, and that of his father was the fur trapper experience of the upper Missouri and the upper Mississippi. Well, that was principally about commerce in the rough and tumble way of the frontier. And you had to learn early on to read people, to know not just if you were going to do the deal, but really if you were going to survive. You're coming in touch with a great variety of tribes, Indian tribes, Native Americans, who didn't necessarily get along one with the other. Very often they did not. So never mind the other trappers and merchants on the river. So it was important in his experience to be able to understand what a person was about and not make a mistake. I think those same sorts of instincts would have served him well in going to France. Let's face it would have been an experience almost as different as our going to Turkmenistan or Mongolia. It's if you just were parachuted in, how would you deal with it? Well, I think you would have to deal, as you say, with people from the heart, and you would just trust your instincts and cope.
Tell us a little bit more about the historical circumstances. You've already spoken a bit about them.
Mm-hmm.
His mother, Sacagawea, she doesn't have a very large part of the book because she died when he was 8 years old. But she really comes forward as a very vivid character. Tell us about her.
Well, the interesting thing about Sacagawea, and perhaps I should start by saying she's a study in what we don't know. Well, starting with the pronunciation of her name. When I was a boy, we learned, and my generation did, her name was Sacagawea with a soft G. Later research and the best thinking now is the G was probably hard, but there's absolutely no way of being sure. We were transliterating from a language that has no writing to one that does. In fact, it's ours, English. And really what we're going with for references to Sacagawea's name are the references, principally William Clark's references, occasionally Meriwether Lewis, in the journals of the Lewis and Clark expedition. So, and they were notoriously bad spellers, so that whether it was a fair representation of how the word was said is just impossible to know. What we know is she was born to the Shoshone tribe on the eastern slope of the Rockies, and then she was kidnapped in a raiding party, which was a common occurrence among the Plains Indians who didn't get along with each other, and there were many. They would steal horses and women, roughly in that order of importance, and young women, and she was taken back to the, this was a Hidatsa raiding party that took her and I think it was four or five other girls back to their tribe about 600 miles away, which might have been the far side of the moon for the distance involved. You just weren't going to go back that distance as a young woman. So she was raised from the age of, we think it was about 12 or 13, among the Hidatsa. And then she was traded to the Mandan, who lived alongside them, and finally ended up as one of the wives, the common law wives, we would say today, of the fur trader, very much older than her. He was in his 40s, Toussaint Charbonneau, a French-Canadian. So already you have this displacement and this extraordinary, just the facts of the little we know is she was somebody who was uprooted from the tribe she was born into. She was raised as a young woman, really. That was about the beginning of womanhood, 12 or 13, and then at the age of 15, we think she was about 15 when she gave birth to Jean-Baptiste Pompey, the young boy who then became the man who is at the center of my story. So the bare bones of her story already suggest someone who's extraordinarily adaptable. I think for a lot of young women on the plains and who were taken and then raised by another tribe, there had to be a point of acceptance and courage to just say, I will go on. You could, of course, give up, and I suppose some of them did, no doubt they did. But it seems from the records we have, in similar situations, there are better records than there are for Sacagawea. You have this extraordinary story of survival and determination. And I think that really, it didn't surprise me, but when I thought about it, I just thought, well, that's, by anybody's lights, in anybody's culture, that's a remarkable life's beginning. And so to go on from there and to give some form to her children's life was before she died at a young age is pretty remarkable.
We're talking with Thad Carhart about his new historical novel, Across the Endless River. It's about Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau, the son of the Indian Sacagawea or Sacagawea, who accompanied Lewis and Clark on their expedition. Yeah, she survived and thrived. She was, of course, the translator for the Lewis and Clark expedition. You have a lovely scene on the beach with her and Pompey. How did she get to the beach? I mean, she had to kind of fight to get there, and we're talking about the Pacific Ocean now.
She did.
And so tell us about that, and then this, the whale that they find.
Well, this and here I will stress, this is not the details are my imaginings, but the contours and the actual dynamic of that event are very clearly described by both Meriwether Lewis and William Clark in their journals. And that is that when they got to the Pacific, they camped on the estuary of the Columbia River, so they weren't right on the ocean. It was some miles away. And they never went to the ocean for some weeks. And then eventually, or small parties would, and eventually But Sacagawea and several of the other participants in the Voyage of Discovery did not go. And then one day a group came back and said, there's a beached whale. We could use the blubber and perhaps some of the flesh. They had a miserable time that winter, I must say, on the Pacific coast. So they were interested in something other than salted fish, which is all they had been eating, and roots. And they made a plan to go the next day. And Sacagawea overheard this and insisted. And what's clear from the journals is she made it clear that she would take it very badly, is the way William Clark, she would take it very badly if she were not allowed to see the big fish and the great salt sea, which she had heard so much about. And you can imagine, walking across the better part of North America, and then with the prospect of in the spring they would turn around and go back, never having seen what they knew then to be the Pacific Ocean, would have been almost unimaginable to our mind. But she really did have to insist. And they set out the next morning at dawn, and they found the carcass of what we presume to be a blue whale. And Clark measured it, as he did everything. It was 105 feet long and had, by that time, been stripped almost bare by the Tillamook Indians, the local tribe. And so there is this extraordinary image of her on the border of the Pacific looking out to... One has to remember that no one knew, certainly no one who lived inland in North America knew what the, and none of the tribal peoples, they knew about the oceans, but they hadn't been there. And so what that experience must have been like to see a boundless expanse of water with waves and so forth is something that absolutely captured my imagination and I try to convey to the reader.
Now, going back to Europe at this point, mm-hmm. Well, he falls into love, our hero here, Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau. He actually falls in love with two women, each of them quite different. One is kind of a mentor in a way. The other is a young woman of also great courage. Tell us briefly about both of them, and then I'll ask you a question.
The first woman with whom he has a liaison was, in fact, I will say here she is a composite character, as I explained in the notes at the end of the novel. There are a great number of documents about women at court and relatives of the Duke of the royal family and similar royal families. But I've imagined her as a character who was named Teresa, a princess who had herself had a French mother and a Württembergian father, which was very common. Württemberg was a small but important kingdom because they intermarried with both the Russian and the English royal families, two of the great powers of Europe, so that this was her path. She was, I suppose you have to say, married off because it really was a political decision. When a young woman came of age, it was about alliances with other royal families. So she was sent off to Russia and married into the Russian royal family, and her husband was killed at the Battle of Borodino, one of the battles with Napoleon. So she was a widow in her 30s when she meets Baptiste, and she is a mentor and a kind of a guide. When you come back to this circumstance of cultural disconnect and cultural overlap, of course it's always helpful to have somebody who can show you a bit of the way, and that I imagine as Teresa's role, and with a background, of course, of great affection among the two of them. But she has no interest in marrying or being with this young man. On the other hand, it's entirely imaginable in my mind, and certainly from the experience we know of the time, that an older woman would take a younger man under her wing and show him the world she knew. The other woman he is involved with, who comes later in the 5 years he spends in Europe, is a young woman whose family had migrated from Ireland to France. There is actually a great tradition after the Battle of the Boyne in 1690 that many Irish moved to the continent, and particularly to France, and very often to the Gironde district, which is now most famous for its winemaking, and even in those days was a winemaking center. And there are still very many families with Irish names, Lynch and Hennessy and Malley and so forth, very great French vineyards. And I imagined her family as one of those families where her mother was still Irish, but her father was third-generation French. And she is trying to make her way in 1820s Paris and finding a certain amount of frustration because, of course, women couldn't have professions. In the 19th century, we know how it progresses, and a very great change did occur for, well, for a lot of people, but particularly for women in the 19th century. But the beginning was not a pretty picture. It was, especially for a woman of means who had her own imagination, never mind the ones who didn't even have any choices, there still was an absolute roadblock in terms of having an independent life in any meaningful sense of the word, much less having a profession.
And she wants to be a doctor.
She wants to be a doctor. In fact, I didn't know, but I found out pretty quickly at the time, and she couldn't be a doctor because you couldn't enroll at the medical school, or you couldn't take a degree. You could actually, you couldn't even enroll. You could audit classes, which was a great indulgence already. The first woman to graduate from medical school in France was in the end of the 1860s, and then it was another few decades where there were a trickle of others. But it's quite remarkable, really, that it was well into the 20th century before there was a serious presence of women, still a great minority, in any of the professions. And so if you think about what that meant, because there was clearly there was a certain amount of wealth and leisure time and opportunity to think about things other than survival. And yet any woman, even a woman of means, really didn't have an opportunity to do anything but go off and make a family and keep the house, however big, and run the affairs of the family. That's, I think, when you make yourself think about what that must have been like for an imaginative and ambitious young person, it's almost unimaginable. I kept thinking about that as I tried to imagine Maura. I think it's important in historical fiction in particular not to project our own value scheme and our own frame of reference back onto the past and say, you know, how did they not have women's organizing groups and so forth. But of course, the background question is still a fair question. How did women do it? How did they adapt? How did they? Because, of course, they did. It's important, I think, to visit these questions in their historical context, but also on a personal level and say, okay, I'm one of these people. What would my feelings be? What would my resentments, what would my frustrations, what would my fulfillments and hopes be? And how does that align or not with what's possible in the world I know? And so you can't know, and it's important, as I say, not to modernize it or romanticize, but at the same time, I think it's those important questions to ask.
And yet, in some ways, they're a very modern couple. They are citizens of the world. They are equals, very much in some ways. And at the end of the book, they return together to America.
What interested me in referring to them as modern, it wasn't my starting point, but it does seem to me there's something that cuts across. And this could be said for different eras, not just the early 19th century. But this idea of going, or the idea of the frontier, which is threaded throughout my book, when most of the book, as you know, takes place in Europe, when Baptiste is in Europe. But there's this idea, not necessarily the romantic or the sentimentalized view of the frontier, because the frontier wasn't all a pretty picture. But what it was, among other things, was a place where social roles and social expectations in terms of what men and women could do, they weren't erased, but they were different from, they were less formulaic and programmed. And so you had to invent more of your life. It was about adapting because you were confronting other cultures and languages, too. And so really what you could do and what you could bring to the equation was equally important, not just, okay, you're going to have my kids and wait at home while I do this. There was a certain amount of that, of course, on the frontier. But in fact, women early on the frontier, and Sacagawea was one instance, would run the accounts for their husband's fur trading operations. And they really ran the business. And so that gives us another angle on what the possibilities were. If you have nothing, and then you have the prospect of, gee, I could be a partner in a meaningful sense to this enterprise, which keeps us alive and going, that's an intriguing thing. So I think that's one of the things in my mind which would have appealed to Maura.
Well, finally, I want to ask you, how was this transition for you from memoir, not just from memoir to fiction, but memoir to historical fiction, which I think is a whole other bag of tricks that you have to pull out. Tell us a bit about the research and what were some of the challenges for you? This is your second book, your first novel, and a historical novel that obviously you did an enormous amount of meticulous research on.
I did, and I think that was both the biggest challenge and the biggest satisfaction, or I should perhaps say the biggest satisfaction, honestly, is having the book appear and tell the story I tried to tell. But along the way, in terms of the research, I've always been a big reader of history, and I know this period pretty well. It's always interesting, both in terms of the New World and in terms of French Revolution, Napoleon, the Restoration, and the beginning of industrialization. It's always fascinated me that the beginning of what we call the modern world, you know, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the French Revolution really changed everything we think. But in fact, it took quite some time for those ideals and some of those principles to filter down and find expression in institutions and practices in Europe and elsewhere. What really was tricky with with any project, but particularly with a historical novel, is I could read happily forever and do more research. You know, there's always one more book and there's one more set of letters. I mean, we have no end of early 19th century correspondences and journals, and which is important in terms of understanding the voice of your characters, but the voice of your time, I'd say. It's a tricky thing because you know it when it's not there. Readers, I think, have what we'd call a perfect ear when it comes to a tone or a voice of a time. If you don't capture it sufficiently well, then the whole thing doesn't work. And so I spent a lot of time on that. On the other hand, at some point, as the French say, il faut trancher, you have to cut through it. This is like cutting through a baguette. You know, you just have to stop it, cut through. You've done your research or whatever you're going to do, and just start writing your story. Because, of course, if a story is going to tell its tale, it's got to work on its own and not just because of the research. At some point, one of my writer friends said, you know what you're doing, don't you? I said, no, what's that? You're taking refuge in detail. And he was absolutely right. That at some point, you keep, I'll just do one more thing, and then I said, no, you really, what you have to do is wrap it up, trancher, and tell your story. And then if you need to do a little extra research and go back and circle around and see, check this, of course you do it. I think it's when you have a feel for your characters and they start to tell the story. It sounds a little hokey, but I did have that experience, and a lot of my writer friends say the same thing, that you can't know, but that after a week or two you realize, oh, I'm not just relying so much on the trappings or the surroundings. Their voices are coming. I know what they're going to say, or I know what they would say to each other. That's a really great kind of experience. So that I enjoyed a lot.
Well, it is a great tale, Across the Endless River. Thanks so much, Ted Carhart, for speaking with us.
Thank you, Francesca.
Ted Carhart writes in Paris. Across the Endless River is his first novel. He's also the author of the memoir, The Piano Shop on the Left Bank. You can find out more about Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau, his mother Sacagawea, and the Lewis and Clark expedition at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.